NREM Breaking News.
Hey everyone, this week we have Al Sacchetti on discussing airway management, pre-oxygenation, oxygenation in patients with COVID-19. This is a great review. I'm going to let Al get right into it.
Unless you've been practicing under a rock for the last couple of months, you know that there's a pandemic. The SARS-CoV-2 virus is pretty much spread throughout the world, and it certainly is in your department. And one of the problems that comes up is, how do you manage the airway and the breathing in somebody who's coughing and spewing virons all over the place, and your job is to minimize that? So one of the issues is, how do you oxygenate somebody without giving them a device that's going to make things worse? Pretty much any device you have to increase someone's oxygenation is going to be an aerosol-generating procedure. And all of them have a certain amount of dispersal of virons into the environment, depending on what device you're using. So I've got Jessica Whittle on the line with me here, and she is going to explain everything from nasal cannulas all the way up to doing a lung transplant. Jessica, why don't you tell these folks a little bit about yourself?
Okay. Hi, I'm a clinician and the research director for our program at Erlanger Hospital in Chattanooga, Tennessee. We're affiliated with the University of Tennessee there.
You're also ACEP's representative to the Infectious Disease Society?
Correct. I've served in that capacity in reference to sepsis guidelines and served on some of the sepsis expert panels for ACEP as well.
Yeah, but we didn't invite you on the MRAP for that. We invited you on for your other hat. What's that?
Well, prior to becoming a clinical physician, I did my PhD work in immunology and molecular pathogenesis, which was specifically focused on viral respiratory illnesses. And I did my work at the CDC in viral respiratory pathogens.
So you know a little bit about something like the SARS-CoV-2 virus. Take me through this. I've got Mr. Jones who comes in. He's got a fever. I want to see if I can get his saturations up. We've got him in some type of makeshift negative pressure area in the emergency department or an isolation room, something along those lines. Everybody's got all their proper gowning, garbing on. They've got N95 masks and face shields. And we go in to see this person. What are we doing to get his oxygen up? Take us through the options. The nurses, as a reflex, grab some nasal oxygen and stick it on him.
So the first thing that we need to do is not reflexively do things in a pandemic. So in the great quote is running around that in a pandemic, there's no emergencies. So I think you pointed out the first thing we do is really pay attention to PPE and patient placement. The second thing is we don't reflexively oxygenate anyone. Only hypoxic patients need supplemental oxygen. And that's really important to avoid any excess aerosol generation. When we think about who needs oxygen, we've decided that we have a patient who actually does. The next thing to remember is that all your knowledge and training up to this point still applies. These patients have viral pneumonia, and you know how to care for that. To really begin to understand this, I think you actually have to take one step back and talk about what we mean when we say aerosolization. I find this is a really complicated situation to talk about, especially with my staff in the hospital, because they keep going on the web and CDC and places like this, and everything is divided between airborne and droplet. The nuclei size of a droplet that contains viable virus, and for the COVID-19 causing virus, that size is 0.7 microns. So anything below 5 microns is considered airborne. Anything above that is considered in need of droplet precautions, but this is a very artificial distinction. It's one that was created in order to try to develop guidelines for protective equipment, but it's not one that exists in the biologic world. So people began to use the concept of aerosol and understanding aerosol clouds as a way to think about this. And it's more valuable, but it's more limited out in the literature when you begin to read about it because it's newer science. To think about this, and what you need to realize is that you have to consider not only the size of the droplet and the composition of the droplet, but the velocity of the droplet as well. So when a person coughs, you'll get showering of lots of droplet sizes, and it can go out many feet. That's independent of if they're on any respiratory support or not. That's true all the time. However, they all go in pretty much one linear direction. And so if you put a mask right in front of them, that mask will catch most of what comes out of that cough, and it will be an effective shield. That's the basis for putting a mask over patients who have a cough. So then when we begin to think in these terms, we can begin to really have meaningful understanding of each of our interventions and what the effect might be. I think anytime you add velocity to a person's exhalation, or increased turbulent flow, you're adding kinetic energy to these air particles, and yes, you will get increased disbursement of aerosolized particles. This can be measured in particularly a gentleman named David Hu in China has done a ton of this work, really beginning in 2003 with the SARS coronavirus and continuing to date. From a lot of his work and other people's as well, we know that a nasal cannula at 2 liters generates a droplet and aerosol dispersal distance of approximately 30 to 40 centimeters from the nose out. So that's a good way to think of the area that you need to consider. So nasal cannulas from 2 to 6 liters per minute of flow cause a dispersal distance that you need to be aware of up to 30 to 40 centimeters.
Okay, now let's take it to something a little different. Suppose I put a mask on and I up my oxygen. Suppose I up it up to 10 liters.
Great. So a simple mask is really not a lot different than a nasal cannula. And it really, of course, doesn't have much more oxygenation capacity. And so it disperses at about the same rate to 40 centimeters. Venturi mask, however, gives you a little more, and it can go also approximately about to 40 centimeters. What's interesting, though, is that if you increase flows quite a bit, you can go to a non-rebreather mask. And because these sit flush against the patient's face, they're actually a bit safer.
So I'm going to put a non-rebreather on you. I'm going to crank my wall oxygen up to flush or, you know, whatever that is, 15 liters a minute. But I'm actually not going to blow the virons as far?
You're not, because of the presence of the reservoir bag and the mask combination, because it will be contained. The patient is actually exhaling into the mask itself, and that's containing those particles. What's leaking out around is actually a low velocity, low kinetic energy event.
And about how far is that going to spread?
The best data that we have from the modeling data, only a couple of centimeters.
Okay. This guy's still hypoxic. I'm now going to do a little bit more, still going to be non-invasive, but now I've got to decide, am I going to put him on CPAP, BiPAP, or am I going to go the high flow or the a high velocity nasal cannulas? Let's say I throw this person on CPAP or BiPAP at 15 over 10. What's it look like now?
Now you've stumbled upon the great debate of the day. The CPAP, BiPAP question is somewhat unanswered at the moment. There certainly has been some success. In China, it's been reported that between 20 and 30% of patients were treated with non-invasive positive pressure ventilation. And certainly in Italy, they're currently reporting as many as 30% of patients are being treated successfully with BiPAP for some amount of time until an ICU room can be available. And some proportion of those are being treated all the way through till recovery with non-invasive positive pressure. The important thing about that to realize, though, is that the Italians use helmet-style BiPAP, and so it has extremely limited infection risk because it's a sealed and contained system. The best data that we have regarding coronaviruses and BiPAP prior to this event really is the 2003 SARS epidemic, and we have data from both Toronto and China indicating that treatment with non-invasive positive pressure ventilation at that time was associated with increased risk for both healthcare providers and nosocomial infection. In fact, in one study, simply working on a ward with a patient being treated on with non-invasive positive pressure ventilation was associated with a threefold increased risk for a healthcare worker infection. So that rivaled only intubation for danger to healthcare workers.
Do you have any numbers on dispersal from a BiPAP CPAP system?
We have numbers based on the idea of a mask leak, and they can go all the way out to 90, 95 centimeters or more. The problem with those numbers is that the models are so variable. And so some of them have exhalation ports that would be at high risk and, of course, need viral filters covering them. And then the other issue then becomes mask fit and all the different styles that are out there. So the problem becomes experimental numbers versus real world effect when dealing with any of these masks. Certainly, at least when it's been measured in an experimental system, dispersal was possible up to 90 or 95 centimeters.
So you're going to oxygenate them, but you're going to make the room a little bit more risk. So that it's really important to have your personal protective equipment on if you're going to be working with somebody on a BiPAP system.
Two other points that I think are important to make about non-invasive positive pressure ventilation systems. Number one, I think that the helmet systems are very safe. The second point is, if you're in a pandemic and surge situation where ventilators are limited, this may be the best option for you, your patients, and in your hospital. And that's a reasonable choice. So it's important that we not make sweeping recommendations that limit physicians in their available options. If this is the best thing in your situation, then use it.
The only other option left for non-invasive management of these people then is the high-flow nasal cannula or the high-velocity nasal insufflation setups. And initially, the CDC and the World Health Organization were critical because they claimed that this aerosolized particles as well. But subsequently, World Health Organization has kind of reversed their opinion. The CDC is kind of easing their criticism of it. And that article that was put out by that international team, the Surviving Sepsis Campaign Guidelines on the Management of Critically Ill Adults with Coronavirus Disease, what they said very clearly was they recommended going to the high-flow nasal cannulas as your first option to avoid intubation in these people. Where do we stand with those?
Yeah, so those are really interesting studies and guidelines. I agree. In addition, even the Italian Thoracic Society agrees with those. German intensivists agrees with those. And that perhaps the most adamant guidelines come out of the Australian and New Zealand intensive care societies, who are very specific that high flow is the option of choice.
The main concern was not whether it supported them, because I think everybody feels comfortable that it does, but that it was a higher risk of aerosolization of the nasal secretions and stuff.
Yeah. So once again, our colleague David Hugh out of China is really the place that we go to look. He's done a wonderful job and published an article in the last year. When Hugh and colleagues did his study with high fidelity human mannequins, he found that in a patient with diseased lungs, like we would see in COVID patients, there was approximately 4.8 centimeters of dispersion. In the very worst case scenario of somebody with extremely healthy lungs, you could get a little farther. The worst they were able to measure with extreme flows and strong lungs was 17 centimeters. But in a more typical scenario with usual therapeutic flow rates in a diseased lung, it would be about 4.8 centimeters.
All right. And I guess the other advantage of these is that you can leave people on them for an extended period of time.
They're also humidified, which can really help optimize their mucociliary function. And we know that that plays a critical role in recovery from pneumonia. So being the ability to maintain that is a really important feature in this.
And then if all else fails, you wind up moving on to endotracheal intubation on these patients, which pretty much all of us are understanding. Maximum protection. It's the worst case scenario for contaminating the staff. Eye shields on everybody, N95 masks, use a video laryngoscope to distance yourself.
It is important that you be really careful, but another great advantage to the high flow therapies is that you can pre-oxygenate the patient with them, meaning leave them on all the way up to the point of the intubation.
Jessica, thank you very, very much. This has been incredibly enlightening.
Take care.
Great information there. And we have discussed this topic with Haney Malamut and Scott Weingart in the past. You can check out those segments as well to get everything you need on how to oxygenate, how to intubate, or how to go about the process of intubating and then mechanically ventilating these patients. There'll be more updates coming. Remember to check out the chapter in Corpendium, which is being updated almost daily as information comes out on COVID-19. We'll have the live events coming up soon. And in the meantime, remember to stay safe out there.